You're listening to the Jefferson Exchange. Thanks for joining us. The JX starts today with the debrief, where JPR reporters discuss the stories they've been covering this week, including a deep dive into chronic absenteeism in public schools, a blowout result in a recall election, and an increase in overdose deaths in Oregon. I'm Roman Battaglia, science, environment, and politics reporter.
And I'm Justin Higginbottom, public health and safety reporter.
Our other reporter, Jane Vaughn, is out today, but I talked with her yesterday about two big education stories she worked on this week. Here's that conversation. Hey there, Jane.
Hey, Roman.
So you published a feature this week about chronic absenteeism in public schools. First, could you give us some background on that?
Yeah, so I found this story basically in some recent data from the Oregon Department of Education. And what they're measuring is called regular attenders. So those are kids who are attending more than 90% of the school days in a year. This data is from the 2023-2024 school year. And so basically there was a slight increase in attendance over the previous year, about 4% increase, which is good. But the thing that I found really interesting is that attendance is still down by 17% since before the COVID years, wow, which is obviously big. So I was curious about why that is, what's happening, how do we fix it? And just to be clear, this is not kids who are leaving and going to homeschooling. Enrollment is different than attendance. So I'm talking about kids who are still enrolled in public school, but they're just not showing up. And it's interesting also because some student groups are absent a lot more often than other groups are. So about 34% of students overall across the state are chronically absent. But if you're Native Hawaiian or Pacific Islander, about 53% of those students are chronically absent. Over 56% of homeless students are chronically absent. And over 64% of currently or formerly incarcerated students are chronically absent. And obviously, this is a really big problem. It can put kids years behind their peers. And obviously, you're trying to build good habits for future careers, future jobs, maybe future school. You know, if you're going to get a job, you have to be able to show up on time every day, and you got to practice that in school. So there's a lot of impacts when kids aren't showing up.
Yeah, I mean, 34% of K-12 students chronically absent is just a lot.
It's a lot.
Thinking about it. So what is causing this problem?
A lot of different things. It's really complicated. So I talked to some kids, for example, who really struggled with remote learning, and then they got behind. And then it's embarrassing that you're behind and you don't want to go, and so school gets a lot harder. It's not as fun. One kid I talked to, Isaac, said that it kind of feeds on itself. So if he goes to school and he sees his friends aren't there, he's like, well, other kids aren't going, my friends aren't there, then I don't want to go either. There's also been some sort of mixed messaging about sickness since the pandemic. So obviously, we all used to stay home and socially distance, and now maybe you don't need to stay home if you've just got the sniffles. Some families have also just gotten out of the habit of going to school, you know, with remote learning, remote work, that sort of get up and go really early in the morning is hard for families. Some kids got more disengaged. Some parents also, you know, don't realize the impact that missing that much school can have, or they don't realize how much school their kid has actually missed. And then there are a lot of other barriers too. You know, one family I talked to said they sometimes need their son to stay home to watch his little nephew and provide childcare when the mom has to work. Some kids have jobs. Some kids are bullied at school or have other social issues that make them not want to go. Again, if you're homeless, you have a much higher rate of being chronically absent. As I said, poverty is a big issue. Transportation is a big issue. So all of these things kind of combined. And then obviously mental health is a big one as well. So one kid I talked to really had debilitating panic attacks when she tried to go back to school full time. So it's a lot of different things causing this.
Yeah, wow. And this is all statewide data that we're looking
at. Yep. Right, and the families that I talked to, obviously we cover mostly southwestern Oregon. So I talked to families in Chiloquin and Klamath Falls.
Mm. And so, I mean, how do we fix this then?
That's a great question because it's very complicated and there's so many different things involved here. So one thing is that a lot of school districts have started attendance teams, so Klamath County School District, Medford School District, and they are working on monitoring all of this data, this attendance data, building positive relationships with families and having sort of positive reinforcement. So sending a little card home like, hey, yay, your kids made it to school. This is great. Or, you know, if a kid is missing school, maybe give a call home and, hey, is everything okay? Kind of checking in. So having that positive relationship between the family and the district. Some districts also are having incentives and rewards. So they'll do like a bubble party or a dance party if, you know, kids show up for however many days in a row, whatever it is. And there's also more of a focus on hands-on project-based learning, things like career and technical education to help get kids more engaged. So I talked to an administrator in Klamath County School District who was saying, you know, that kind of helps If you've got a project that you're working on, you're building a shed, you're cooking a meal, you've got to be there in person. Your team is counting on you, and that's more engaging, that sort of hands-on learning for some kids. So that's been helping a little bit. And like I said, for the kids that I've talked to, one of them is now going into school for 2.5 hours a day, which is obviously not a full day, but that's working for her. She's there every single day, getting done what she can, and then has sort of other programs outside of that. And one has been meeting with a teacher at the beginning of each day to help him catch up on the things that he missed, and he really likes that. So for those kids, that's working well for them, and their attendance has improved. So overall, like I said, statewide, attendance is slowly improving, which is good. But the question is kind of how long will it take to get back to pre-pandemic levels, if it does at all? And then what sort of impacts is it having in the meantime?
Yeah, interesting. I mean, I can certainly see lots of different things trying to get kids back to school. I know that when I was in school, that hands-on learning was definitely a way to kind of get you back in there because you had projects that you were working on, relying on folks.
Yeah.
So you also covered, you know, another story this week about a big update to the Ashland School District's precarious financial situation. Mm-hmm. What's happening there?
So the Ashland School District is in a little bit of a financial crisis. So if nothing had changed, they were on track to be in the hole by over $1 million by the end of this fiscal year. They also don't have enough money to cover their expenditures through October. And so they've done a bunch of listening sessions recently with staff and with the community to sort of provide updates on the situation and also get feedback and suggestions from the community on how to fix it. And they've really considered a lot of different solutions to try to solve this problem.
Got it. So they're not doing very well, but what's the recent news then?
So the big news is that they got an anonymous donation of almost $1 million.
Wow.
So that helped a lot. And then the school board also approved some other things to help with this. So they're going to have up to 6 furlough days for the rest of this school year, which will help cut some costs. They're reducing some contracted services. They're continuing a freeze on discretionary spending. They're reducing some staff through attrition. They say they don't anticipate actually laying off any staff this year, although they did lay off some staff at the end of the 2024 school year. And there are some other things as well. And so all of that stuff together means that the district is going to save over $2.2 million this fiscal year, which is really more than they need, but it gives them a little bit of wiggle room for any unanticipated costs they have and gives them a little bit of, 2.5% reserves, which is good. But they're not really out of the woods yet, so that sort of first hurdle has been cleared. But now, as I said, they don't have enough money to make it to November 2025. They need another $3.5 million in cash in order to make it to November, which is when property tax payments arrive. And then after that, they also need to create a long-term plan for financial stability, 3 to 5 years. How are they going to survive, basically?
Yeah, wow. I mean, you can't just keep staying in this hole and trying to dig yourself out again and again.
Right.
So how did the district get here then?
So Ashland is not really alone in this problem. A lot of districts in the state are struggling with financial issues. So there's problems with inflation and increased special education needs. So there's a lot of factors that go into it. But Ashland is having to change its budget mid-year. There's, too high of expenditures. They don't have enough revenue, declining enrollment, like all these things that other districts are also struggling with. But the big thing, I think, at Ashland School District is their staffing. So they chose to spend their COVID relief money to hire over 70 new full-time staff to help sort of maintain operations and enforce social distancing and all the COVID things. And that kind of caught up with them. They thought there'd be more attrition, but now they have all these new staff that they have to pay for, and that's expensive. So that's a big problem for the Ashland School District for sure.
Got it. Great. We'll have to see what happens there. Thanks, Jane.
Thank you.
So Roman, turning to you, you reported on an election that happened in Josephine County this week. What was that election all about?
Yeah, so there was a special election to recall Josephine County Commissioner John West. It's kind of strange that it happened, just a month after the November election, but the deadline to turn in signatures was on Halloween, and so the election had to happen soon after that. There was a lot lower turnout than the November election, only around a third of voters participated, but, the preliminary results show that an overwhelming number of voters approving the recall and, sending West packing.
And why were people trying to recall this commissioner, John West?
Yeah, it was really a broad group of people. West was only 2 years into his first four-year term, but he angered a lot of different groups of people doing things like, he kind of mishandled the sale of this plot of forest land owned by the county known as Pipe Fork. He was part of the group that defunded the OSU Extension Service and the 4-H program in the county, kind of deregulated and stripped out wildfire prevention programs and public safety. And so all of these different groups kind of came together for the recall. Lily Morgan is the lead behind the recall, and she's a Republican, a former House representative. But I also talked to, you know, a Democrat that's part of the campaign, and it was kind of about bringing together the voters who felt that West wasn't representing their interests.
Yeah, so that result, his recall, was pretty overwhelming. What does it say about how people feel about the governance for the county, for Josephine County?
Yeah, I mean, about two-thirds of the voters in the election voted to recall him. I mean, it basically says that people were clearly tired of the past 2 years of how things have been going in Josephine County. West was the last commissioner who would have been sticking around into the next year. One commissioner stepped down earlier this year. The other one didn't run for re-election. So that means there's going to be an entire new group of three people running the county starting on January 1st. West didn't end up answering my calls for the story, so I won't really know how he feels about this result.
Yeah, that's a bummer when that happens. So didn't West also file a lawsuit trying to stop this recall from happening? What happened with that suit?
Yeah, it was about the way the signatures were validated in the petition for the recall. He said that they all needed to be validated, but there's state law that says that you can just take a sample of those and validate those. And so a judge heard the case a day after the election and then threw it out. Basically, the Grants Pass Daily Courier reported that, you know, the judge said that, you know, this validation method has been settled for decades. It's not really a point, essentially.
And who's going to replace West once he's out?
Yeah, so who's not technically out until the election is certified, which could take up until mid-January. And then once that happens, the remaining two commissioners will have 30 days to appoint a replacement, and they'll serve out the last 2 years of West's term. The two people taking the seats next year were supported by West. So, you know, Lily Morgan, the leader of the recall, said she's kind of worried about their independence, but that this recall is obviously a sign that voters are watching and making sure, you know, keeping an eye on the commissioners.
Okay, great. Thanks, Roman.
Yeah. Justin, you reported on new data for overdose deaths in our region. What did you find?
So this was finalized 2023 data released by the Oregon Health Authority, so last year's numbers. And what that shows is during 2023, overdose deaths still rose significantly. We've been on an upward trend for a while now. And as a state, as a whole, just over 1,800 people died from overdose. That's up 450 people from the previous year. And so that's statewide, but we saw a similar increase in our region, southwestern Oregon. Deaths rose by about 30% in 2023 compared to 2022. Over 300 people died, the majority in Jackson County. It is the most populous county in our region, so that makes sense. But that's bad news. The culprit seems still to be fentanyl, but also methamphetamine, which I don't think people really realize that meth also causes overdoses with, you know, heart attacks and stroke. And for the statewide data, actually, just over half of overdose deaths involved both an opioid like fentanyl and a stimulant like methamphetamine. So people are using these drugs together, which can be very dangerous.
Yeah, wow. I mean, that's such a big increase in deaths that we saw. Is Oregon following the similar trends nationwide?
We're not, actually. So nationwide data shows a drop in overdose deaths in 2023, and that's the first drop since really before the pandemic. Oregon's only one of a handful of states that didn't see this drop in 2023. Nationwide, we had just over 84,000 deaths in 2022, and in 2023, it went down to 81,000. So kind of good news, but that's, you know, those numbers are just incredible. It's the population of Medford dying every year.
Wow.
But at least that number isn't growing. And we don't really know why this decrease in overdose deaths is happening on a nationwide scale. I spoke with some experts and they had theories like it could be a change in the drug supply. Maybe the strength of fentanyl is changing, although we don't have research on that. Also, overdose medication might be more prevalent. And also a really dark reason is just those at most risk for overdose have already died. It's kind of like a disease going through the population. It's already tore through that minority.
Yeah. I mean, do we know then why overdose deaths in Oregon have continued to increase while the rest of the country saw a drop?
We don't really know that either. You know, fentanyl has been a driver of overdose deaths, like I mentioned. And one theory is that it came to the West later than the rest of the country. So it's taken us a while to ramp up resources. Although Oregon does spend a significant amount on these kinds of resources. Between 2021 and 2023, state spent nearly $1 billion on resources for drug users. Although, and just the last thing I'll say is there might be good news on the horizon. The OHA's early 2024 data shows those deaths might finally be dropping, but we won't know that for sure.
That's good. Great. Thanks, Justin. That's it for the debrief this week and for this year. Thanks for listening. You can reach the newsroom with our comments about our coverage and suggestions for things we should cover in the future through our news tip line on our website at ijpr.org. And you can find this program and more on our website at jeffexchange.org or subscribe on Apple, Spotify, and all the other platforms.